Hey, Anna, you know astronomers lead very exciting lives, right?
Oh, you're serious. Yeah, uh-huh. Yep.
So I know everybody thinks, all right, they're always up at night, they're late, yeah. They're stay up late, that kind of thing. So what do astronomers do during the daytime?
Sleep.
Some do. Yes, that's true. It's true. Some do. But I was thinking there's a whole other branch of astronomers that do things during the daytime. They study what's up in the daytime. They study the sun.
Oh, okay.
Now, of course, you're not supposed to just stare up at the sun, right?
That is not good for your eyes.
No.
You heard it here first, kids.
But, very good advice. Yep. But we have lots of satellites that are watching the sun 24 hours a day. So mm-hmm. they're up in space. They're watching the sun. That's activity. And some of these spacecrafts have been around for a long time. There's one called SOHO. There's Ooh. Two other ones called STEREO, and there's another one called the Solar Dynamics Observatory. And if you want to have some fun at work and waste a little time and not do actual work, go to those three websites
uh-huh.
and check out all these cool solar videos with big sunstorms and sunspots Ooh. And eruptions and pretty cool stuff.
Sounds cool.
So it's not just stars at night. We do a lot of stuff during the daytime.
You must be exhausted from the cool, exciting life you're living.
It is true. It's nonstop. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
Both from the Cincinnati Observatory. Dean's the astronomer, and I have all kinds of questions. In this episode, Joe Palca, longtime science correspondent for NPR, joins us to talk Mars and Joe's big idea. All right, so astronomers during the day, I just imagine y'all sleeping.
Well, like, some do. That's true.
Well, I mean, but I think those sometimes people do say, like at the observatory, they're like, oh, what do you guys do during the day? And we're like, well, we do look at the sun.
Yeah, I mean, you need day jobs. I mean, the astronomers that couldn't study cosmology and things like that, they're like, it was their second choice, I guess, is the sun, maybe.
Every time someone says cosmology, by the way, I think cosmetology, and I just start laughing, thinking about planets done up in makeup.
Oh, yeah.
That's fine. Sorry.
But on to the sun stuff. It's called heliophysics.
I should keep some thoughts inside my head.
Nah, okay. That's what this is for.
That's right.
We're all here for you.
Exactly. All right, heliophysics, a very cool sounding name.
Yes. And so we've got this new spacecraft that just launched in August that made all these big news. I mean, because mm-hmm. it was this giant launch with this humongous rocket. It got people pretty excited.
Thrusters.
The whole thing. So it's called the Parker Solar Probe Mission.
Mm-hmm.
And its goal is to skim the sun. That sounds like a...
I hope the AC is working in that rocket.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God. Or whatever it would be called.
It sounds like a disastrous idea. They're going to fly this spacecraft as close to the sun as possible.
Which is still hilariously far away, right?
It's still pretty far away. Like, Good point.
Okay. We switched roles there.
I know.
Because I was kind of a downer.
Right.
And you were trying to be optimistic.
No, but you're right. It still sounds like it's really far. It's going to miss the sun by only 4 million miles.
Practically brushing up right against it.
Well, so this is the tricky part. So where they're going to be flying.
This is the tricky. Okay,
well,
what is
the
it?
Whole thing. The
no,
launch
I know.
Is pretty tricky too, but
I'm
getting
excited.
There. So they're going to fly through this very, the upper atmosphere of the sun called mm-hmm. the corona.
Okay.
And the idea is to fly through there and to see what is going on in the corona, because this is a big mystery in astronomy, is that the surface of the sun is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, off of the surface of the sun is this area that's by the corona, and it's 1 million degrees Fahrenheit.
Wait, it's hotter.
Exactly. Why is it hotter if it's off of the sun?
This is a conspiracy.
We don't know the answer to this.
And
so that's what the Parker probe is all about. It's going to fly through the corona of the sun.
Okay.
And it's going to try to test it out and see what is going on there. Why is this part that's less dense, that's off of the sun, why is that hotter than the sun itself?
Wait, how are they What is the spaceship made out of that they're going to be able to, like, I said spaceship? What is it? What would it be called?
I don't know. I hope it's not made out of ice because it's not going to make
it. I was going to say, well, I mean, how are they even going to do that? Well, so it seems very dangerous.
It is very dangerous.
Whose idea was this? Who greenlit this project?
I don't know, but it was an interesting.
It's brave.
Brave.
We'll say brave.
Bold. Bold idea.
Ooh, I like that even better.
Now, they have these shields, these shielding that they have on spacecraft,
okay,
like when they re-enter orbit or things like that. So they can diffuse the heat to some extent.
Okay.
So, but still, it's still very dangerous to go through a 1,000,000-degree Fahrenheit area.
You said that so clinically.
I know,
like,
that was...
you know, it could be disastrous going through, like, yeah.
It'd be slightly
sorry.
Warm to the touch.
They might perspire slightly.
Right.
Just on their forehead. I'm sweating just thinking about it. That sounds like a nightmare.
I know.
Sorry.
And the trick is
cool.
To go through fast. You don't want to linger. You don't want to stay there.
You're just like, you're all in.
You don't want to put your toe in. You want to just fly right by. And so this spacecraft could end up being the fastest thing ever made by humans.
Oh.
Its top speed could be 430,000 miles per hour. And 430,000 miles per hour. That is like you could go to the sun very fast at that speed.
But what would that be if – I guess you can't do that on Earth because it's too fast.
Nope.
I was going to say, like, you could get to, like, whatever in, like, a minute,
yep,
like, from across, but
yep,
it's even too fast for that.
Yep. And so
I like to bring things down to earth for our listeners, Dean, so that's why I was asking that, but okay.
All right, well, let's see. Speed limit is 65.
This is like an SAT question. Right. If this rocket leaves from here and this rocket, you know, when will they combust from the sheer heat of the sun's outer core, outer crust?
So this thing's just going to go like right through the corona very quickly.
Is that smart, would you say?
I don't know of how smart it is. This is we're not sure what's going to happen to this thing.
Has there ever been a mission like this?
No. Nobody's gotten that close to the sun before. There was one that got a little close. I can't remember if it was called Ulysses or something else. I was thinking.
Was it called Icarus?
Icarus was what I was thinking. But no, it's not Icarus.
Because that would be hysterical.
Well, that would have made more sense because I don't think it worked.
Or Daedalus, I guess. And then
Daedalus.
Whatever.
Icarus, yeah.
And NASA would be there. Okay.
But it's going to not only go through the corona one time, it's going to go over and over and over again.
What?
It's going to be in this long elliptical orbit where it's going to go right by the sun and then go out to the solar system, almost all the way out to where Venus is. In fact, they're going to use Venus as kind of a little slingshot to put it in the right trajectory. You know, Venus is there. Might as well use
it. Yeah, why not?
And again, this is probably thought of just to show off again. I mean, it's pretty much what NASA does. But so it's going to go around the sun about every 88 days. So every 88 days, it's going to go back for another pass.
Okay.
And I don't know.
So no one's in this thing.
No, it's definitely unmanned. That's for sure.
I just don't even people in it. Like,
double
this is
check.
A nightmare.
It's good to double check.
Yeah, right. Like, I you guys are, no one's up there, right?
I hope they locked before it launched. They're like, okay, everybody out. I think Dave's still up in the compartment.
He was Windexing one of the windshields.
Well,
windshields.
I'm sure he's fine.
He's going to
sure
love
he's
it.
Fine.
He's
sure
going
to
love
fine.
It.
So yeah, every 88 days it's going to go around. And,
wow.
And I don't know if the plan is, let's see how many times it can make it. Will it make it once, twice, six times? Six is the plan.
Is it really?
Yeah, they're trying to do that six times.
And they're
going to
send data back? And
yep, every time.
Okay.
So the first flyby, from what I could tell, is November 1st. So it launched August 12th, and it's going to be around there. First sun flyby, November 1st. So it's pretty exciting. So we'll get some news pretty soon about this.
Yeah. Who's Parker?
You weren't supposed to ask that question because
I forgot to study
that one. Shoot.
That is like the basic question.
Well,
what did you think I was going to ask?
Well,
how many astronomical I mean, come on. What am I going to ask? Who the heck's Parker?
We'll have to add that in later.
Okay. Somebody pause, look it up.
We'll add it in later.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, Anna.
However, I was hoping you'd ask about the other spacecrafts that are up there.
Okay.
You know.
Okay. What? I'm not your puppet. Okay. What other spacecraft?
Well, now that you mentioned the other spacecrafts that are in orbit,
I totally did organically.
No, the one that's called SOHO has been around there since the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and
that's
then
fine.
The STEREO missions, those ones. So it's called STEREO because they launch two spacecrafts off of the Earth in opposite directions,
mm-hmm,
and they went around the sun in opposite directions, and then they got on opposite sides of the sun for a short period of time, so they could watch both sides of the sun at the same time. Because here on Earth, all we could see is the one side that's facing
us. The sun's like, can I get a little privacy?
Yeah, but we had no idea what's going around on the other side.
Okay.
Yeah, we were like, what's going on the other side? And so the stereo mission that was there on, so we got the backside of the sun for a while. But yeah, the Solar Dynamics Observatory, man, that one is making some really cool videos. They can show the solar activity where these big prominences are shooting off the sun.
Yeah, that probably looks terrifying though, right? I mean, because I imagine like a giant wave of like literally red hot, like flaming whatever, just coming right at the camera.
Yeah, plasma coming right at you. Yeah.
Right in your face.
And these are the scale and the size of this stuff. Like, I mean, you got to look at the sun. The sun is 864,000 miles in diameter.
Yeah.
So you could, it's 1 million times bigger than the Earth. And you see a jet of plasma shooting off the sun.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa, that's big.
Right.
That's good. That'd wipe out the entire Earth. But we're 93 million miles away.
Yeah.
So we're fine here. We're fine. But the.
But
the Parker Solar Probe, let's just see what happens.
I can't wait.
I mean, it's going to be exciting to see.
88 days and count. Well, less than that, but counting.
I know. So we'll see what happens on the first flyby, if it survives, and we'll see what results we get and what's going on in the corona.
Now I'm emotionally invested.
I know. Well, we'll tune in.
All right. Well, since, you know, Dean slacked off, the producers found the answer to the big question Dean did not know, which is, who is Parker?
God bless them for finding the answer and saving
me. God bless them and Google.
Yeah, so this is named after Eugene Parker, Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago.
Wow.
This is actually the first mission named after a person that's still alive.
Oh.
So this is a guy that studied the sun.
Wow.
And so this is all for him.
Is he still works there now?
Why are you going to ask me another question?
I wish you all could see the look on Dean's face. It was like pure contempt. I'm sorry.
I answered the question you asked. Do you have to ask me another question? That's it.
Okay, just take that part off.
The recent Mars opposition brought the red planet as close to Earth as it's been since 2003. So we wanted to talk about that with the man who covered it for NPR and the man behind Joe's Big Idea, NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet.
So I think the big astronomical story of the summer was Mars and the Mars opposition and the close approach. And so you did a great job of reporting on it. How did that come about, and how did you guys get the word on it, and how did you report on it?
I think the first piece of information I got on it about was NASA. They're very eager to celebrate all their achievements with any astronomical event that they can find.
And oh, you don't
about,
say.
yeah, no, it's true. I'm sorry. And it's kind of interesting and confusing, and it was a little hard to describe. And tell you the truth, I didn't really get the relationship of the brightness and Mars and the opposition until I had thought about it a lot. And then right at the end, I had an interesting conversation with Paul Chodas, who is at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And he's the guy who's in charge of the position of every object in the solar system. They don't go where he tells them to, but he knows where they are.
Wow.
And he was telling me the most interesting thing. This just cracked me up. So if you look at every piece of coverage, every news report, everything said July 27th. And I called Paul Chodas and I said, actually, when does this? And he said, you know, I'm not really sure. I'm going to have to get back to you. He called me back an hour later. He said, it was really bothering me. So I looked it up. The opposition occurred at July 27th at 0229 Universal Time.
Oh,
UT.
Man.
And what does that mean? It means it was July 26th.
For the United States. Yep.
For the United States.
yep.
So it cracked me up. So anyway, the point of this was it didn't really matter. I mean, the exact moment of opposition was sort of irrelevant. The point is that when they all line up like that, they're bright. And the other point is that when they all line up and Mars is close to its closest approach to the sun, it's going to line up and be brighter. And that was the whole business about this particular opposition.
Oh, yeah. And I think it did matter to us because everybody showed up on the 27th to the observatory. They didn't show up on the 26th, so they right. Well, they took all right. your story.
So you could have said nanny, nanny, boo-boo and laughed at them, but I That's didn't think true. That was appropriate.
Yeah, because you think, well, if you could see it tomorrow, it would be just as close. I mean, just come back
well,
tomorrow.
That's what people said. That's what, you know, they really, it's actually funny because I think it sort of points to the lack of understanding, and I don't mean to make fun, but people said, well, will we still be able to see it tomorrow? And I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, it's not like there's an on-off switch when the moon's on.
Yeah.
It's just not going to be as bright. And probably the difference between the 27th and the 28th or the 27th and the 31st, which was the actual day when the perihelion of Mars took place, I think that's right.
Yep.
Wouldn't be, I mean, you know, to the naked eye, I don't think so. I don't think anybody would have noticed the difference.
So kind of going from a very current story to going back to the year beginnings of, you started NPR in 1992, I believe I read. How did you get started? What brought you to NPR? What interests you about science? Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, well, you said we only had 8 minutes. I'm sorry. That's a much longer discussion. I have a PhD in psychology from the University of California, Santa Cruz. And actually, I think probably it's not really a good excuse, but I think I first got interested in astronomy per se because UCSC is where the Lick Observatory is located. And they had all the computers that I had one computer in my lab and nobody knew how to use it except the people at Lick. So I had to go over there to get instructions on how to use the computer in my psychology lab. But then I left academic science completely and wound up wandering in the science reporting world for a while. And I actually came to NPR from Science Magazine, where I was a print correspondent. So, yeah, I mean, when did I get interested? I got interested a long time ago. I didn't come, I'm not from a journalism background, I'm from a science background.
Yeah, I was going to ask about your PhD in psychology.
Yep.
Does it come in handy with dealing with people there at NPR? Can you analyze your coworkers?
Yeah, not so much. I tell people I was good with rats.
Oh.
In fact, I did human. This is almost as bad because I did human sleep physiology, and then of course people want to know if I can help them with their sleep problems.
Ah.
Oh, I do, but you get
I cannot.
That one.
Yeah. No.
I'm going to scratch my follow-up question.
Oh, well, I guess
about
you can't ask him that. I was going to ask about hypnotists, if he could hypnotize me.
Oh.
Analyze my past lives. Okay, well, anyway.
Oh, my God. So I know you said you're a writer, and that's kind of something that you do, but you also have a podcast, right? Joe's Big Idea?
It's funny you call it a podcast. It's not a podcast. I wish it were a podcast.
Oh.
It's not a podcast. It is a series.
A series. NPR, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, no, because in essence, what is a podcast today? I mean, when I came into radio in 1992, there were no podcasts, of course, because mm-hmm. there was no pods. But the point is, it was a radio thing, and the way that you listen to the radio is you flip on your radio.
Mm-hmm.
But now, with the multiple platforms that audio is available on, you can have your story come on, you know, at 4 o'clock on All Things Considered or any time of day or night when you listen on your podcast player. So in a sense, the stories I do could all be put together into what you would call a podcast, but I don't have a thing that starts with an introduction and then plays music and then, you know, has the format of a podcast. So
right.
No, I have a series on NPR. And then, so that's the sad part. The nice part is it's a great series. It's given me a chance to stop focusing on results because I think science is, you know, as you guys will know, is incremental. And so what happens is every increment gets built up into it's a big news story and sometimes it just isn't. Mostly it's just isn't. And so instead of saying, okay, here's the latest result, I'm looking into what I call the minds and motivations of scientists and inventors. So it's just a way of saying, how did you get here? It's like what you're asking me. How did it happen that you became a scientist? Why did you get interested in this topic? Where does it take the field? What do you think it means? Without saying, this will change your life.
Well, and so how do you get your tips, your news tips, and what's next? What's on your horizon that you're looking at?
Well, the tips come from all over. You know, I was just we're speaking astronomy. I'm planning a trip to the Kavli Institute of Astronomy and Astrophysics in Beijing in September.
Oh.
It's part of another trip I'm on. And there's a woman who's on, I think, the board, or at least she's affiliated with it, named Sandy Faber, who happens to be an astronomer at UC Santa Cruz. And so she and I were communicating as I wanted to ask her about the Kavli Institute. And she said, oh, here's this other thing I want to tell you about, this new project we're starting at UC Santa Cruz. And that's sort of how it goes. You know, you talk to people, they say, hey, this is really interesting that we're doing. The project has to do with perceptions of time and deep time and things like that. But it's very hit or miss. It's sometimes it's talking to you, you know, talking to you guys. It could be just something that walks across the horizon that looks interesting to me.
Oh, wow. And so how can people find Joe's Big Idea?
Well, actually, the good news is if you Google Joe's Big Idea, you'll find me.
All right, there we go.
Nobody else named Joe's had a big idea, it sounds like.
That's true. Well,
you have the franchise on it.
I guess.
Trademarked.
Yeah. Well, we have a button. If you want a button, I can send you one.
Really? Oh, Anna's a sucker for buttons.
I do like buttons.
Stickers
and
are
stickers,
even better,
yeah.
But buttons are pretty good.
We have koozies, I think.
What?
Keychains, buttons.
Wow.
Swag.
Yeah.
Swag,
see, that's right. The difference between his show and a podcast.
That's
we don't have any of that
stuff. We don't have
stuff.
Any of that.
Dig deep for the $25.
Now, hopefully they're listening about this. Isn't anyway,
that's right.
We've been talking with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. Joe, thanks so much for talking with us today.
In the more than a century, the Cincinnati Observatory has been around. In fact, almost two centuries at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine some of the correspondences we've received with some very personal, very unique perspectives on space, science, whatever. And because of our discussion about Mars in opposition, I want to talk about one that I have seen on a more modern crank file source social media.
Mm-hmm.
And it is Mercury in retrograde.
Mercury in retrograde.
This is something I want your thoughts on. Is it a real thing? Can people use it for whatever reason they want to cover up or make justifications for their behaviors?
Oh, man. We're going into astrology
here.
We are. This is
your
where,
favorite place.
This is where we can maybe threaten to lose some listeners here if I start to get going too much.
Oh, good. We'll cut you off if you do.
I'll keep myself at a 5 for this one. I'm not going to go to 9 or 10 of the... I'll keep it lighter.
Okay.
I'll try.
Yeah, do your best.
Okay. So Mercury in retrograde. Now, yeah, this is like the latest thing, right?
And
so
it's a
when
thing.
when you see it on the internet, it's usually like explaining like, well, you know, that happened because Mercury's in retrograde.
Yeah.
Right? And weird things happen when Mercury's in retrograde.
And you're supposed to be like, oh well.
Now, this is one of the greatest things astrologers could do because Mercury does go in retrograde so often.
Oh, my gosh.
That's the thing.
Breaking
so
news.
You could have, like, it's the perfect excuse.
You'd be like, I smashed right into your car, broke the fender. You know what? Mercury's
retrograde. Sorry.
Peace.
That's right. Oh, I forgot to pick you up from the airport. But, you know, Mercury's retrograde.
Uber it.
Exactly. And this is, like, the perfect astrological excuse. Now, it is an astronomical thing. This is what happens when a planet is moving across the background stars. So that's what planets do. They change their position. The constellations all stay the same. So like Orion and they move together, but the planets shift differently.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time planets go forward in their orbits. And so they go forward, past the stars. And then they'll stop and then turn around and go backwards for a while.
Okay.
That's called retrograde. And it's all just an illusion because the Earth is going around the sun. These planets are going around the sun. So they're all going at different speeds. So it's basically like we catch up to them and they'll go backwards or they're
just
going
taking
so fast.
A minute.
Exactly.
And they're going to come, they're going to go forward again.
Right. So this is how we figured out that the planets went around the sun, not around the Earth, because we could explain it. If everything went around the sun, then that explains this backwards retrograde motion.
Oh.
But Mercury is the one that does it the most because it's so fast, going around the sun so fast.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that you can hardly ever see Mercury in the actual sky. So whenever you see Mercury in retrograde, that's the times where you can't really actually physically see it. Or at least not very often.
Oh, okay.
So you can only see Mercury about like a couple weeks out of every year in the sky. But it has absolutely nothing to do with anything in
okay,
on Earth.
Dean, you said a five.
Oh, sorry.
You're getting a little like...
Is that six or seven?
Absolutely nothing. I was like, oh, no.
Okay, well, it doesn't have anything statistically that we can associate with Mercury in retrograde. And then, of course...
At all.
Okay. I'll keep it calm, everybody.
Like Bob Ross voice.
That's
like,
right. That's right. Oh, like when Mercury's
NPR
in...
NPR voice.
Well, you know, I get worked up whenever Mars is in opposition. So this is kind of what happens. So
is it your Saturn return?
This is my Saturn return, too. There's the Jupiter, Mars, Venus triangle. You got to watch out for all
that's
sorts
right.
of stuff.
So many pitfalls.
Yep. So now this is one of the things with astrology is that this was a thing to do in the ancient world. It was kind of a pursuit for the elite. They could figure out where the planets were and try to figure out things were going on. And then in the Middle Ages, they were used by some of the actual astronomers. So Galileo and Kepler and Copernicus did astrological charts.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would like make predictions for the wealthy people mostly to do this. But what happened is that in the 1700s, we figured out, okay, the planets, we figured out gravity, basically. Newton figured out this law of gravity and said, well, those planets are so far away and so small that they have no impact on us gravitationally.
Okay.
And he could show this very easily to people and say, you know, Mars is over there. Yeah, it's there, but it's not doing anything to you. It's not affecting you. And so in the Enlightenment, astrology died out basically because they could show these planets do nothing. Oh wait, I'm getting up to seven again.
You're like, I'm just saying, Enlightenment and astrology don't go together.
Exactly. And in fact, an astrologer was took issue once time when I said that.
Uh-oh. You know,
he said, I call it the Endarkenment. And I was like,
ooh, oh,
that's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah. And I was like, okay, well, that's good too.
Anyway. Let me show you out.
That's right. So we figured out in the 1700s and 1800s, astrology wasn't an effective thing. And then it got brought back in the 20th century and is now a public thing. So it's like it's open to everybody. It's not just for the elite. It's for
social
people.
Media.
And it is fun. But yeah, it's basically now used as an excuse. And I remember I had a friend whose mom was an astrologer. And she said,
oh, no.
I was like, what was it like? You know, and she was like, my mom uses every little thing for an excuse. She did use an excuse. Yeah, I didn't pick you up at soccer practice because, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
Saturn is there and, you know, oh, I forgot your birthday because of this and that kind of stuff. I know.
Oh, my gosh.
So that is the real use for astrology.
Yeah.
Excuses.
All I've pulled from this, we need a whole show about astrology and just watch your head explode.
Oh,
it'll be entertaining for me.
I'm very calm.
Yeah, I feel like you're gripping the side of your chair.
Underneath the seat, I'm like,
you
can't see it.
Crush a can with your bare hands. Grr. Oh my gosh. Well, way to take that like a champ.
That's right.
Way to stay calm.
Thank you, everybody.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Joe Palca from NPR for joining us today. You'll find a link to Joe's Big Idea stories on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup.
We'd like to hear from you. On social media, you can find us on Facebook. Just search Looking Up WVXU. And on Twitter, we're at Looking Up Podcast. You can also drop us an email at lookingup@wvxu.org.
We'd really love to hear from all of you about what got you interested in space, what your favorite planet is, or any questions you'd like us to explore. Send us an email or post on Facebook or Twitter.
And remember to subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts. And give us a rating and comment on iTunes. If you're new to Looking Up, you can always find all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Our theme song and additional music is by Why, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.